You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Ralph R. Frericks, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at UCLA. We discuss his new book, Deadly River, Cholera and Cover-Up in Post-Earthquake Haiti, published by Cornell University Press. I began our conversation by asking Professor Frericks to talk about why it is important to know how a disease outbreak began.
It's like in any investigation. This book tells about an epidemiological investigation, and in this respect, epidemiologists are disease detectives. Mm-hmm. And they go about their work with biologic agents the same way that people in the criminal world do with criminal investigations. And typically, you might think that somebody was, say, doing a mass murder. And when the mass murder occurs, then all of a sudden you have different paramedics come in, you have police come in to maintain order, you have all kinds of people showing up at the time of the mass murder. But when the detectives come in, what you expect of them is to find out who did it,
right.
Who was responsible for this event. And it's the same way pretty much with any outbreak that occurs. You have epidemiologists that come in. They're expected to find out what started this, what were the factors that led up to it. And then they use this information to perhaps create legislation for the future in terms of things that need to be tightened up, laws that may need to be tightened up. Or they institute alterations, say, in food practices and procedures, all those kinds of things. But it all emanates from understanding the source. So the source is very, very important.
Okay.
And like any detective work, is you have to get there early. You have to get there before the footprints start fading away.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first thing that typically epidemiologists do.
All right. Now, in this case, the outbreak was cholera in Haiti, and the early indications were that it had something to do with the Artibonite. I don't know how to say that. River, is that the correct pronunciation?
The Artibonite River is correct.
Okay. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the importance of water when it comes to cholera and why following the water became so important in this investigation.
Well, cholera is kind of an unusual organism. It's been around. It's caused by the organism is Vibrio cholera.
Mm-hmm.
And Vibrio cholera is a name that's given to actually more than 200 varieties of this organism. But there's only two that have a toxin, and it's the toxin that gets liberated by the organism that causes the disease that we think of as cholera. But what all of the Vibrio cholera have in common is that they have a little flagella at the back that allows them to flicker back and forth and slide effortlessly through water.
Hmm.
And Vibrio cholera is known as a water-loving organism that is, in fact, found in the waters throughout the world, but not the toxigenic form, but rather the regular Vibrio cholera form. But unfortunately, people get them confused because all of them have the same name, of Vibrio cholerae.
And they are related?
They're all related, except that only a couple of forms, a couple of them, of the 200 or so varieties, produce this toxin. It's the toxin that we think of that the causing the harm in humans that we think that we know is associated with a cholera disease.
Okay, all right. Now, when it comes to talking about recent history in Haiti, of course, we all think very quickly of the earthquake that hit Haiti, and that was in 2010, and then the cholera outbreak was months later, and so there was some confusion perhaps about whether or not the earthquake had anything to do with it. It had a very abrupt onset and was very fast moving once the epidemic hit. So what were people's initial thoughts about the association of the earthquake?
Well, the earthquake, as you say, occurred in January of 2009. It was a very big earthquake and just killed hundreds of thousands of people. It mainly hit in the southern part of the nation, close to Port-au-Prince, which is the capital of Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused, like I say, great damage there. Then everybody at the time was thinking that, oh my goodness, after an earthquake like this, then, you know, epidemics are going to spring forth and that there's going to be all kinds of after effects, not just the aftershocks of an earthquake, but after effects from a biologic standpoint. So there's a lot of prediction about outbreaks and diseases and such that were going to occur. But nothing happened. Mm-hmm. There were considerable damage from the earthquake, but I'm saying from a biologic standpoint, from biologic agent standpoint, nothing happened. And then another 9 months went by, and all of a sudden, in the interior of the country, some ways away from the earthquake zone, a new disaster struck, and that was cholera. This is a country that had never had cholera before, ever in its history. Had avoided it in one way or another, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, this cholera outbreak comes, and it starts and seems to then explode along this Artibonite River,
right,
along in communities that were lying on the edge of the Artibonite River, and it was a very unusual pattern. Normally, if cholera comes to another country, it starts kind of slowly and builds up steam in a slow way. But this didn't. It all of a sudden just, bam, it just exploded and spread down Artibonite River, and then after that, then shifted and spread throughout the country.
Right. Now, and it's a relatively small country, but within its own scope, it was interesting that it started quite far away from Port-au-Prince, and it was clearly not, or timing-wise, it wasn't like something that happened right after the earthquake in that same area of that earthquake.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So this came to the attention of epidemiologists and one in France, Renaud Pierrot. Is that how you say his name?
You can say it a lot of different ways. If you speak French, you'd say Renaud Pierrot.
Okay.
But being the fact that we're in the United States, that we don't necessarily pronounce everybody's name as it is said in their home country, we here refer to him as Renaud Pierrot.
Oh, okay. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how he got involved in this situation in Haiti. Your book, Deadly River, is very largely about Renaud and his investigation of cholera. So who brought him in to consult, and how did he initially become involved?
Well, one might think, if somebody knows about Haiti, and again, those who have been to the country and spent time there and have followed its history, it becomes apparent that the epidemiologists who are there, the outside epidemiologists, come from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. They have an outpost that's there. And there are some epidemiologists there that are affiliated with the Pan American Health Organization. So these are the two groups that are there separate from the Haitian epidemiologists. The odd part about this epidemic is that, and the CDC epidemiologists have been there for quite a few years, because earlier Haiti had a big problem with HIV infection, HIV/AIDS, and they had sent epidemiologists down. They had actually training programs for Haitian epidemiologists there. A laboratory was set up by CDC to assist there, and that they had people in and out all the time. So when this great cholera epidemic struck the country, the most logical thing would have been to have the epidemiologists that are there with the Pan American Health Organization, that's the regional office of the World Health Organization, mm-hmm. or the CDC epidemiologists jump on this thing and immediately figure out what's going on. This is typically the kind of thing that CDC people love, because it's a mystery. It's a great mystery. What happened? You know, just had come to this area for the first time, and here's this poor southern neighbor of the United States. And it should have been catnip for them, just a great thing. But for some reason or another, they didn't. They didn't want to get involved. And they said, "Oh no, we're too busy dealing with cholera patients. We're too busy setting up healthcare system. We're too busy doing all kinds of things." And that may be true, is that CDC did have many people that were busy with these things, but not epidemiologists. Mm. That you can't go having detectives telling you they can't detect. It's an odd thing,
right.
But they did, and they voiced their thoughts to the news media and such. So it wasn't that this was a secret that they were not detecting. They had said so out and out. So the Haitian government wanting to know how this deadly disease got to them, they reached out to France. Haiti had become independent from France in 1805, and so it's long been an independent nation. But they still had connections with France, and the French language is spoken widely. Mm-hmm. So they reached out to France, and they said, well, do you folks have any epidemiologists there who can kind of help us figuring out how this disease came here and why it spread in such a dramatic manner and what to expect in the future, what we can do about it? And it turns out that there was a prominent physician and PhD, infectious disease specialist, Bernard Perrault, who was in Marseille, in a southern city of France. And he had been studying cholera in various areas of the world, not just the organism, but the epidemic forms. He'd been studying how these epidemics occur, what the shape is like, what goes on with it, and published on this. And they said, well, he sounds like a good fellow, and they invited him to come in. So on the first reporting of cholera occurred on October 21st, and Perrault then showed up a couple of weeks later on November 7th. He managed to get his affairs in order and came on November 7th ready for a field investigation.
Okay. And you, meanwhile, you were watching all of this at a remove out of professional interest. And so how and when did you get involved in the story and playing a role?
Well, I'm certainly I'm a retired professor, and I'm certainly a minor character in this book. Is that I was reading the newspapers about this, and I was a little startled by CDC's comments, and so that kind of perked me up when I saw them behaving in an atypical manner. And at the time, I had just been retired for a few years, but I was still teaching a summer class on epidemiology at UCLA. And I'm always looking around for examples, you know, interesting things to share with the students about what was going on in the world around them. And this certainly was an interesting epidemic. So I started paying attention to it. And when the odd elements came forth, there's a number of odd elements that I describe in the book, I decided that this needed a larger audience. I am also author of a large website that has about 2 million hits or so a year on a fellow named John Snow, who was the father of epidemiology. And Snow gained a lot of his fame during the mid-1800s in London for work on cholera. So I decided to add a column to my John Snow site talking about this odd epidemic that was occurring in Haiti, this explosive epidemic that was occurring in Haiti, and the unusual reaction of some epidemiologists, and the fact that all of a sudden here is a new epidemiologist, new to the region, Renaud Perrault, who is a French epidemiologist, called in to do the basic work that typically is done by people in my profession.
Yeah. Now, this might be a good time for us to talk a little bit about the role that NGOs play in Haiti. Do you want to just address that real briefly?
I've worked in a lot of different developing countries during my career. And again, I've had a long career at UCLA, and I towards the second half of it, I started specializing in problems in developing countries. Mm-hmm. So I've gone to a lot of different places. And typically what you see is that you see governments that are there that are set up, and they may not operate in the most efficient manner, local governments, but they operate. They pride themselves on their independence from others. And NGOs, when they come in, they go through the government. That the mm-hmm. government sets the tone, says, here's what it is that we need. And they say, well, we can help you in this area or that area. The government says, fine. And the two groups work actively together. Haiti was startling to me because it was so different from that mm-hmm. model. In Haiti, what you ended up having is a weaker government, and you'd have these people with these NGOs that would come down and all looking to do good. When I chuckle about it, I don't imply that I'm laughing at these people at all, but rather at the situation, because you just have tons of NGOs that would show up and not go through the government, but they'd decide that they wanted to work on some project, and they'd go off to that place and start working on that project. They'd have people come down from the United States or other places and help. And they're springing up all over the place. And later, in reading more about the Haiti experience and what was going on there, the background and all that, I saw this quote that came up about how Haiti is the land of 1,000 NGOs. And I think that pretty well lays it out, is that you've got all these uncoordinated groups that come down there. The Haiti, where the NGOs come into this drama, is that earlier Haiti had considerable problems, the violence, other difficulties, and in 2004, the UN stepped in and said that they wanted to stabilize the situation, and that they wanted to provide basically law and order to Haiti. So at the time, there was a document that was put forward, and it basically stressed to the NGOs that this would be the group that the UN peacekeepers now coming into the country would be the group that would maintain order within the country. And the NGOs, I think, signed off on a unusual bargain that, yes, that they would be free to do whatever it is that they wanted to do in terms of providing humanitarian assistance to the country, but that, they're the police for them, the order in the community for them, would be provided by these UN people. So in an odd sort of way, the NGOs were beholden to the UN to allow them to do the work that they were doing.
So I wonder, one thing that really stood out to me was that the UN, it became clear at a certain point that there was the possibility that some of the UN peacekeepers from Nepal had been had been involved in the cholera epidemic getting to Haiti. And they were not particularly honest about what they thought might have happened. And later, Renaud Perot says, in telling the truth, the UN could have gained the trust of the population and facilitated the fight against cholera. The deception shocked me. I don't think of the UN as behaving in this way. I wondered what was their motivation in being deceptive, and if you can talk a little bit about that.
I think you're not the only one who is shocked by that. Normally, I come from the field of public health. Mm-hmm. And in the world of public health, we venerate organizations like the United Nations, World Health Organization, CDC, and others, because we assume is that they're there to do good, that their intention is to do good. Right. The United Nations especially is one that often talks about human rights, about caring about impoverished people around the world. And so we look up to these organizations. And what was a little startling to me is that as I started to investigate in this book, is that here it wasn't a oil company that was doing bad, or a company that deals with toxic chemicals or whatnot, but rather here it was an organization that I had always looked up to, the United Nations, that was doing bad. And so it made an interesting a case study, if you will, is what happens when good organizations go bad,
yeah,
or make a mistake. And we've had a great movie that occurred earlier in the year that if you're a fan of the Oscars and whatnot, if you saw Spotlight.
I did,
and
yeah.
Spotlight also was in the situation where all of a sudden a great organization, one of the major religious institutions in the world, when all of a sudden people that worked for that organization as priests were involved in pedophilia. And you'll notice in Spotlight, the interesting thing was that when it was the confrontation in the Boston area, I mean, the story for the movie was based in Boston, and that when the reporters then investigating all this confronted ordinary people about it, or even some of the reporters themselves, there was this urge for denial, because the organization itself, in their mind, was such a great organization that it couldn't have done this. And it was very distressful to people to think that a great organization could have done this. Mm-hmm. Now we come into a situation that's a bit more secular, but again, a noble organization and an organization that went awry. And I think is that people find this an interesting portrayal, if you will, because it's not something that we often talk about.
Well, and actually, it's a really good analogy, because in both cases, it's an organization that really relies on public support, and
right.
And you know, in that light, you can sort of see that they would not want to have. I mean, it's very bad PR that they made this particular mistake. I'm not talking about the church anymore, but you know that the UN made this mistake. It's very bad PR, and if they could have covered it up, they probably would have preferred it never get out. So that does make sense then. In that light.
The other thing that happened is that once it became apparent that the United Nations had was involved in this outbreak, then human rights groups got involved. And so there was a group that was down in Haiti that teamed up with a group in Boston, and they decided to initiate a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawsuit was against the United Nations for not having proper supervision over the local people and creating this situation or serving as the causative agent. And the lawsuit then went forward. So now they were asking not only for a call by the United Nations to tell the truth, in which they joined Renaud Perot and others who wanted that as well, but they added another element, a liability element, in which there was money involved, and that they felt that of the 9,000 to 12,000 people who died in Haiti due to this epidemic, or the 800,000 who came down with cholera due to the epidemic, that these people and their families, their survivors, needed some compensation. So a major, major lawsuit went forward as well.
Right.
So now the UN is sitting there and looking at a public relations disaster if it turns out that they are incriminated as being the agent that brought cholera to Haiti, and they're looking at a financial impact. That's a major impact that can affect their ability to do peacekeeping work in other parts of the world. So there was it was definitely money and other factors, reputation factors that came into play.
Yeah. Now the mistakes that they did make, there were a couple of big mistakes that were made. One of them was that Nepal is known to be a site where cholera exists, and so these incoming peacekeepers should have been tested, and were not adequately tested, if at all. I don't remember if there was any testing done. And then the other side of it was that the sewage coming out of the camp where they were staying was not properly disposed of, and that was a huge, huge problem, because in the end it got dumped in a stream that led into the river. So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about those two situations.
Well, some would say that they were tested before leaving Nepal, but that the test was the eyeball test.
Oh.
In other words, somebody looks at you, he says, "You got any diarrhea?"
Oh.
And the soldier says, no diarrhea. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So it you could call it a test, but most common sense would tell you that there was no testing. But I'm saying is that the you could have a you could refer to it that way. And so all of these soldiers, the soldiers have a basic desire to get involved. Nepalese soldiers have a basic desire to get involved in this peacekeeping effort. They get about $1,000 a month during the 6 month tours that they do in foreign countries, and that money from that then comes both to them and their families. They have a welfare fund that gets set up that once they retire from the military, that their family will be supported through insurance and things like that. So there's an eagerness to get involved, and it's not illogical that somebody who maybe had diarrhea picked it up in Nepal, that they would not want to drop out of this tour and would continue. And it turned out that there was an outbreak in Nepal shortly before they left, and that we think that they got infected. They flew on a plane with all the other troops together. Vibrio cholera has a fairly short incubation period of typically only a couple of days. So it's likely that other people got infected during the plane ride, or then when they landed in Port-au-Prince, they took a bus then to Mirebalais, the interior town, and during the bus ride, or during the first day or two in the camp that they were in, that there were ample opportunities there for becoming, for this epidemic to get sparked and to take off within the group of Nepalese soldiers.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast for writers and curious readers. Today's guest is Ralph R. Frericks, author of Deadly River, Cholera and Cover-Up in Post-Earthquake Haiti, published by Cornell University Press. Now, one thing that really surprised me as I read the book was that it was not very long into his investigation before Pierrot knew probably what had happened, and yet there was so much that he had to track down, and people were afraid to speak. They were afraid of getting in trouble. Even members of the CDC were conflicted about what they might say because of the politics and their professional repercussions, and that was just shocking to me. And then there were a lot of rumors that abounded. You have a chapter about the rumors that will happen in a crisis. One other thing that was interesting was that a lot of the Haitians felt that this had to do with voodoo, sorcery. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that, too, but also just rumors in a crisis and how hard it must be to track down the real truth when there's so much to kind of focus on.
Well, some of you may have read a book that Jonathan Katz had written earlier that talked about the earthquake and then the subsequent cholera epidemic that occurred. Jonathan Katz was a reporter for the Associated mm-hmm. Press, and he had first come to Haiti in 2007. So he had been there for quite some while, 3 years before all of this occurred, and was very familiar with the situation in Haiti. So he had heard a rumor about a friend of his that told him that there was an article in a Nepalese newspaper about cholera being there, and he'd heard a rumor about these troops being infected in this base that was south of Mirebalais. So on October 27th, he decided to go to the base in order to investigate. And on the same day, there was another international reporter there, Sebastian Walker, who was with Al Jazeera Network. And Sebastian Walker does a video production. So you had one doing video production, one doing writing. And both of these men ended up in at the UN base on the same day in October 27th. Mm-hmm. And they one broadcast and by video, the other then wrote his story up. So when Katz wrote his story up, the AP feed went out, and somebody in Canada picked it up in Montreal, which is a French-speaking area, and they published it on October 28th. And so there was the first story in in French that was out there was on the 28th. And Renaud, having planned now to come to Haiti, was thinking about it and all, happened to be looking on the internet, and he came across this story in French that about Nepalese peacekeepers. So at that time, he had that thought in mind that, oh, here's an interesting hypothesis. But he, like other detectives, he lines up many different hypotheses. What you end mm-hmm. up doing is you consider a myriad of hypotheses. It sometimes frustrates people when they hear detectives talk, because you may have like 20 or 30 different things that could have happened, and they say, well, why don't you just focus in? But the first step is not to focus in. The first step is to sit there and lay out all the possibilities. And once you've laid out all the possibilities, then on the second phase, to sit there and weed through these and to see which of those possibilities are most likely. So this is his way of thinking. He kind of filed this away in the back of his mind before coming to Haiti. Then when he arrived in Haiti, he started some interviews initially right at the beginning with important people, the Minister of Health, the President of the country, head of the Medical Association, others like that. He wanted to find out from them what they thought was going on. And so he happened to mention this story that he'd read in the Montreal paper, And they all said, "Oh, no, it's just a rumor. Don't you know? It's just one of these journalists writing stuff, and they don't have any facts in back of them, and disregard that." So he got that statement about disregard this or it's just a rumor from a lot of different people on the Haitian side. But he noticed that over time, that at first that they also were kind of suspicious of him, an outsider, even though he spoke French to them, that an outsider from another country, that he was different. He was different from them. But he has a curious manner about him. He's very able to get along very well with people. He's kind of a burly guy, around 6 feet, and looks a bit formidable, but a terrific guy to talk to, makes people at ease, and they open up to him, and that they can see that he's a pure scientist, that he's not there with a political issues, or he's strictly looking from a scientific standpoint at what it is that that occurred. So they started opening up to him, and at that point he recognized that, well, maybe this rumor that this guy Katz had written about was not just a rumor. Maybe there was more to it. So that hypothesis on his second wave of thinking came more to the front, and eventually he then went to the did his field investigation. He's what we refer to as a shoe leather epidemiologist. He mm-hmm. likes getting out, getting dirty, and going around and into the field. And so he went into the field, and he started to investigate to see what this Nepalese business was all about.
You know, and the your mention of those two journalists brings up another point, which is just the incredible importance of responsible journalism, how vital that is in a situation like this. And I think in recent years we've come to sort of have a little bit of a cynicism around the media and the way that the media handles our own politicians with a little bit of kid gloves, or just, you know, it's very divisive, as is everything in America right now. But just to see the responsibility of these journalists getting out there and getting the answers, and that was a part of your book that I really enjoyed.
They were terrific, as was a third journalist that I didn't mention, because he's a Haitian. I mentioned focus on the two international journalists, but there was also a Haitian journalist, Roberson Alphonse, who works for El Novelista, which is the Haitian newspaper, and he had a lot of pressure on him.
Yeah.
These international journalists didn't have a lot of pressure on them. I mean, they faced danger, you know, when they were doing their reporting, in case somebody would not like what they were doing. But it wasn't pressure from their bosses or pressures from their government or anything to not respond. So the courage, there was a courage from physical dangers, but not necessarily from mental or career dangers in the same way that Roberson Alphonse, for example, likely faced. So he came along, and under all this pressure, I thought he did a remarkable job, because he also went into the field a short time after, and it got underway, and he also did a video transmission that I came across that was just pretty surprising to me. And he then published some things about the epidemic as well, did some interviews with some of the people that were doing the initial investigation, and he also was one of the three, if we look at the heroes, the journalistic heroes that were especially cited in the book, that he was one of those three.
Yeah. And that, again, is another great comparison to Spotlight, which is also about journalists that are uncovering difficult truths. All right, Ralph, I would like to talk a little bit about the book and your working on this book, how it came that you wrote the book, and what your approach was to writing it, and also how involved was Renaud in the writing of the book.
Well, as I mentioned, I was retired, so here am I. I'm in a little town that's in Southern California, now a little bit of a distance from UCLA, but still in the warm weather of the region. Mm-hmm. And I was retired, and I was focusing a lot on photography and other things at the time, but this story sparked my interest. And the more I got into it, and the more the oddities of the beginning caught my eye, then I just got more and more intensely into it. And when Renaud finished his report, he left the country on November 28th and came back home and immediately finished his report. And there was a that he sent in to the Haitian government and to the French government. And that report was leaked in this in the subsequent weeks was leaked to the press. Mm-hmm. And that report then got published online, and I got a copy of it. That, you know, and looking at stories about all this, I got a copy of this report. So I don't speak French, and I got a, but I, the report was all in French, and got a copy. And at the time, Google was had the main translation program, but they would only translate a few sentences at a time. They wouldn't, like, do a whole big document like they do now. And so I sat down and I took his PDF file, the file of his mission report, and slowly started teasing out the sentences and translating it and coming up with a poor English translation of what occurred. And I then took that poor English translation and put the French and the poor English translation on the web, on my on this website that I had started to build on the outbreak. So I go into the in early January. I go into my kitchen and talk to my wife about it. And I said, you know, about this unusual guy. She knows that I've kind of gotten somewhat obsessed with this whole thing, and mentioned that he'd written this report, and I finally figured out what was going on from him, but that I wasn't quite sure, you know, that I'd gotten the exact translation. So she says, well, why don't you write him? And sometimes, you know, it takes an outsider to kind of smack you on the side of the head.
Yeah.
and, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't I write him? And so I did. And I sent him an email, and I'd gotten his email address, and I'd sent him an email. And then a day or so later, he writes back, and very friendly, very open. And it turned out it kind of caught him at the bottom of a cycle. If you can imagine, here's somebody now who's a disease detective, goes to a country, investigates, and they find that the most powerful agency in the world is the culpable agent mm-hmm. that they're theorizing. Most powerful agency in the world. And so he's a guy who is a he's head of a parasitic mycological mycology lab in Marseille, and he's also a faculty member of Aix-Marseille University in Marseille. And so he's a professor, head of a lab, but he's not used to dealing with these huge political forces that are out there. So he's feeling a bit glum is because there's a lot of pressure on him, you know, the fact that he brought up this association, and a lot of pressure on him to not go forward with this investigation. And lo and behold, out of the blue, here comes this email from some retired guy in Southern California showing support. You know, yeah. Showing sympathy, support, understanding. So he latched on, and he wrote me back, and he sent me some very, very interesting inside documents that he'd had with different people. And I started getting involved with it. And then over the course of time, it turned out that we were two individuals that shared the same respect for science, mm-hmm. the respect for truth-seeking. And we both apparently had the same tenacious personality that would allow us to just go forward. I always thought that he was a lot braver, though, than I was because he's still working. I mean, I'm retired, and there isn't a whole lot bad that can happen to me. But in his case, I mean, he was right. He's 20 years younger than I am, and he was right in the middle of his career on this. But anyway, we ended up bonding, and at first, what we planned to do is to go strictly through scientific articles and clarification. So what he had published the initial article, which is a very definitive article on what took place, and I was just kind of now helping him with other matters. We'd go back and forth, and I was still trying to describe what it is that had occurred and what took place. There was no thought of a book at this point. And eventually, the UN and the CDC and others, their opinions were starting to prevail, and it looked like people would eventually just ignore his initial article. So he asked me to, he knew that I had been assembling all the different evidence, the scientific evidence that was coming out about this whole process. And so he asked me to be the lead author on another article, and we developed a team. There was a team of us that were doing it, but I was the one that created the first draft. That on terms of, you know, what took place, it wasn't just Bernard's report now, it was a report of others as well. And so that article came out, and we thought that that would put the matter to rest, and that would be the kind of the end of it. And that was basically going to be my contribution to this, is writing that article, and because he was the one who was doing the field investigation. Right. But it didn't stop. Nothing stopped. So the obfuscation continued. The cover-up seemed to continue, intensify. The UN wouldn't admit any responsibility of what they had done. And so this process just continued. And so he had visited me. He and his wife had visited my wife and I in Southern California. And we corresponded, I think, almost every day. And then we had visited them in France. And during our French visit, he took me out to this little hamlet that was in the countryside where he had been building a country home. And we were spending the night there. And he brought up this issue. He said, you know, he said, I think that we ought to write a book about this.
Yeah.
The problem had now expanded, especially with this cover-up of all the unusual behavior of the UN and such. So I thought, well, you know, that'd be great. The two of us will write a book. And he seemed a little hesitant at the time about the two of us writing the book. Is that Bernard's kind of a humble guy. He doesn't like tooting his own horn and talking about himself so much. But I insisted because he was the one who did the field investigation. He was the star. You know, he was the one who was out there in the field doing all these things. I'm just this retired professor. So we decided that the two of us would do it together. And we worked on this. Then over the course of time, the story kept getting more and more complex because there was more, as you could see, you know, in reading it, that it had all these different elements that were coming right and left in various ways. And so it took us quite a while to unravel all this. The story took place over a 4.5-year period. So there was a lot of investigation. And we got close to kind of finishing this. Cornell University Press had said that they were going to publish it, and they were working with us as the editors. But then the issue came up is how to tell the story, how best to tell the story.
Yeah.
And I tried to do it in third person, with always referring to Perot, and then I'd be referring to, if I was involved in parts, I'd be referring to myself as Frerix. And that came across as kind of odd. And so then I started referring to myself as I, you know, and still him as Perot. But anyway, the editors just looked at it and they said, you know, this is just, it just doesn't work out right. What we think that you should do is that you should be the primary author, and that the story then would be basically about him and his investigation.
Yes.
So I mentioned this. I was kind of hesitant about mentioning this to him. It's like they suggested he stop being an author. Well, he loved it.
Yeah.
He loved stepping back from being an author, because what he had wanted all along, he had wanted me to be the storyteller and him to be the, you know, it's his story. It's his
right.
story and what he's doing. And he knew that I had the background in order to tell the story, because I've taught epidemiology all these years and experiences of my own and all, but basically that this would be the arrangement. So the what we also decided on is that my role would be minimal in it. So I basically am introduced in the preface of the book, in which I tell a little bit about myself, who I am as the author, but that basically from then on he was the story. He's the main component. And some reviewers, in fact, have noticed that this is really a story about a French epidemiologist in Haiti. It's not primarily a book about Haiti, but it's a book about this French epidemiologist doing his investigation in Haiti, and those reviewers are absolutely right. That is the drama. Haiti is the setting for this drama that unfolded in the life of this curious character, curious to people in the United States who may not know very much about a French epidemiologist, how people think, how people go about their processes and the like.
Right. Well, and ultimately it is sort of, as you said earlier, a detective story, and he's the detective. And, you know, I mean, it's a scientific story, and it's a Haitian story, and it's a story of disease, but it's a detective story, and, you know, that's the approach that you took, and it works very, very well. You mentioned earlier that you are retired, and so you don't have any fear of what the book could create or could have created while you were working on it. Are there any ramifications that may or may not happen from this book being published?
I'm not sure. You know, it's again, you go back to spotlight.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that those journalists were fearful that somehow or another that the Catholic Church would excommunicate them or denigrate them or whatnot. I think is that the book, in trying to address this problem, we tried to be fair and open and well documented everything that was included, so that I have not seen any comments in which anyone has said, oh, you know, this guy Frerichs, he's off on this factor or that factor. In fact, everybody who has seen the book seems to be exceptionally respectful of the amount of effort that went into documenting exactly what it was said.
Yeah.
I didn't do that many interviews. I did some interviews, but not that many interviews, because I wanted the characters that came into play to speak through what they said in the news media or what they said in other places, so that it was well-sourced.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just that I had this secret conversation in which I exposed, you know, whatever it is that they had on their mind. So I think that and then as it turns out, like in any tale, an evolving tale, you end up getting allies.
Yes.
And so at first it was a small group that believed like we did, and then that group started growing. And in fact, Renaud had a process that he was working towards in how to eliminate cholera from Haiti that we'll get into, and I suspect shortly.
Yeah.
And the book was supposed to be this to explain the whole process to people, but not just technical people, not just scientists, but to try to write it in such a way that non-scientists could appreciate also what it is that happened in a major sense. And as the book comes out, you develop new allies, people that support you and say, yes, you know, we agree with you. The journalists, the three journalists that I mentioned, all obviously agree with us because we're all on the same page. The human rights group that's doing the lawsuit, they agree with us because they see that exactly what happened. And so now the UN, CDC, and WHO, they're all pretty much on the defensive because, you know, people are starting to see that there was a different side to what it is that they had been putting forth.
And various epidemiologists have also agreed with the premise of the book as well. Is that correct?
Well, there were some that were the world of cholera. I might back up. The world of cholera from a scientific standpoint is quite small.
Mm-hmm.
There are a handful of prominent people who write about cholera. Many write just about the organism itself, but I'm saying about the cholera and epidemic cholera, that there aren't really that many. And that the group that is most prolific in this tends to be associated with a facility in Dhaka, Bangladesh, called the International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research in Bangladesh. And the Bangladesh group had developed over the course of time a theory that cholera springs forth from the environment, that mm-hmm. there's these good cholera agents, organisms, and the bad cholera organisms, and that the good ones that are out there floating around in the water, that periodically they have what's called a genomic retransformation, which means is that part of the genetic elements of the organism get moved from one organism to another, and that the new organism that develops as a result of this movement of this genetic material is one that becomes pathogenic or disease-causing, and that it then springs forth from the coastal waterways in these different countries and starts a epidemic. And that new theory, it is now becoming, or had become, kind of the standard theory about cholera, and a lot of scientists believe that that's what took place. I mentioned that I was a great fan of John Snow, the father of epidemiology. Mm-hmm. During the 1800s, there was also a few theories at work, and Snow was kind of a rebel and went against that, and he believed that cholera was started by a microbe. Even though that microbe had not been seen yet or identified by scientists, but through deductive logic, he thought that there must have been a microbe that was out there. And he basically believed the same way about the human activity theory that Perot now believes today. But that was not the prevailing theory anymore in recent times. Now, Perot comes along, and he's doing studies in Africa and in the Congo and Comoros and other countries of Africa, and he's studying epidemics there, cholera epidemics, and he becomes convinced that the human activity theory, that the humans are needed in order to keep cholera going in an epidemic. What he's assuming is that somebody becomes infected. They then in turn, if the agent gets into their stomach, they have vomiting. If it gets into their gastrointestinal tract, then they have this profuse diarrhea. There's a rapid water loss or fluid loss in the individual, and unless that fluid is replenished, then the individual dies. And so it's quite dramatic disease. But during that exodus of vomit and diarrhea, that if it happens to then get into the household water supply, then other members of the household will drink that water, you know, and get infected themselves, or if it happens to contaminate the kitchen or other areas like that, or even bedding, if the bedding remains moist and somebody else then sleeps on the bedding, or if it gets into a stream and stays in the stream for a short while, then others who drink from that stream can also get infected. Mm-hmm. So this organism can stay in the water, but the theory is that the human activity theory is that unless there is constant human amplification, meaning that it gets into other humans and gets amplified and there's more of it, that eventually the organism would get washed out of the system and it would go away. The environmental theory, on the other hand, assumes that once it springs forth from these estuaries, these coastal estuaries and whatnot, gets involved in the population, that it remains there. It remains then potentially in the coastal waters, always ready to spring forth again, and that once the disease starts in a country, that it remains basically in the country unless there are dramatic alterations in things like sanitation and water systems, perhaps vaccination, huge mass vaccination to suppress the organism. So two theories.
And that actually does sort of bring us to what you had mentioned a minute ago, which was then the last thing, or one of the last things that Renaud did in Haiti, was to develop a cholera elimination program, trying to eliminate it from the country or do the best that they can. So I wondered if we can just sort of briefly talk about what was involved in that program. We're winding down on time a little bit here, but I'm curious also how successful it's been at this stage in time.
Well, the people who believed in the environmental theory wanted to do a large-scale program. They wanted to raise $2.2 billion over a 10-year horizon in order to do this program, or they wanted to do a mass vaccination program because they felt that this was the only way that you're going to control this disease in mm-hmm. Haiti. Those things are very expensive, and Renaud worried that with this large amount of money that's asked of outsiders, that they would never be able to raise that money, and in the meanwhile that Haitians would continue to suffer. So he studied this, and he felt, because of his belief in the human activity theory, that that he needs to look at this and see how to get rid of that organism from Haiti. And Haiti has a dry season and a wet season, and what he found is that during the dry season that naturally the number of hot spots of cholera would diminish, and that when the wet season came, all of a sudden the disease would just start up again because people would become increasingly infective and spread it from one to the another. So he decided that using maps that he would set up a system in which during the dry season they would look for these hot spots throughout the country. They would send out a mobile team to the different hot spots, and they would treat then the local people. They'd give them chlorine for their water supply, the household water supply, and they'd give them some health education. And so he would be putting out these hot spots during the dry season. The theory was if you could put out all of the hot spots during the dry season, that when the wet season comes in, there's nothing to intensify. There's no cholera left to intensify. And this theory was based on work that had been done in the island of Madagascar, where years earlier in the 1970s, they had done a similar thing, and it had worked out very well in eliminating cholera, and in another island nation of Comoros that was close to Madagascar, where they also had to use a similar strategy. So he was convinced that this elimination strategy, and he did a lot of research to show why it would work and such. They had research studies that were going on in Haiti. So almost everybody was convinced, but not everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The program got going. They had these mobile teams that went out. But in some parts of the country, lo and behold, sure enough, cholera drastically went down. I mean, it was really a dramatic reduction from the high numbers that were earlier.
And you even say in the book that at some points it surprised him how much it had gone down. It was more than he had even expected.
Yes, that they found it was a very successful, and that they thought that they were well on the road to elimination. But then it turns out that not every area was involved. Some local political leaders and public health leaders felt that a vaccination program, for example, would be better, or they felt that they ought to hold out for water and sanitation improvement. And these things brought money into the country, and the elimination program that Perot put forward didn't really help anybody other than the Haitian people. Mm-hmm. It was a program that would get rid of cholera completely, not bring in new medical care for cholera, not bring in new health facilities for cholera, not bring in all the sanitation, water improvements for cholera, but rather just eliminate the disease per se. All the other impoverished elements of Haiti would remain the same, but there would be no cholera. So he had a hard time getting everybody on board, that there was some political dissension, and that political dissension that developed then gradually eroded the success that they initially had. And so now Haiti is seeing a resurgence of cholera in various areas, and once it gets a head of steam up again and starts increasing, it becomes harder and harder to control. So he's trying to now to continue to get the financial. First, he has to get the support of people to understand what is needed for this elimination program, get everybody on board thinking about it, and that was one of the reasons for the book, is that the book would give the overview of what happened and hopefully bring people together to recognizing that this elimination strategy is a sound one, and that when that happens, then that his hope is that some limited money would be available to finance these mobile teams, continue to finance them, and that cholera would no longer be a problem in Haiti.
All right. That's wonderful. I have one last question for you. So the listeners of my show are writers as well as readers, and so I tend to wrap things up by asking for a little piece of advice. And in your case, I thought I would ask you if you have any advice for authors who maybe are working on books that have political ramifications, books that might have professional ramifications even, and maybe if you had any guidelines for yourself as you worked on this book, maybe you can share a little bit of that along with this advice.
Actually, I have a lot of advice. It's unfortunately that you only have a few minutes, so let me just give the highlights. That this is what happens when you talk to a professor. I started out as a science writer, of scientific articles and book chapters and so forth. And so I did quite a bit of publishing like people in academia do in that regard. And when we tell our normal stories, it's more linear. Everything is pretty much linear. This happens, that happens. And we use time in a standard way to tell a story. And what the first draft, when I put this thing all together, was exciting to me, but boring to my wife, boring to other people, you know, to read it, because it didn't have this elements that engaged the reader. And we ended up then hiring, our editor at Cornell suggested that we get an outside editor to help us. And so we got a fellow to help us who was just amazingly helpful. He sat there and took the longer, boring story and divided it up into many different component parts. And so he had these little 3x5 cards that he put on the wall of all the different elements on it. And he recognized that he could rearrange things and that rearrange in a different order. So he did this, and then he came back to us and suggested that maybe we ought to tell the story in this way. The same elements were there, right. But they were rearranged in a different way. And that helped us a lot. That all of a sudden we let go of time, and so the story is able to kind of move back and forth a bit more than we started out. The second thing that he helped us a lot about is that after we got through with much of the book, he said we've got to add some color elements to add humanity to the individual characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went back again, and that's why you have these stories about Renaud sitting in a restaurant, you know, eating something or going there and giving his impression of when he saw this beautiful scenery or this or that, given more of his thoughts and adding a human element to him, something that I was unfamiliar with when writing typical science articles.
Yeah, I remember there was a great scene where he's on the airplane and he really needs to sleep, but it's so hard for him to sleep because he's got all these thoughts in his head. And that was actually a very engaging moment, so that's probably one of those moments you added in.
Right. That's right. And trying to see how best to tell that aspect of the story, mm-hmm. that to get that to come forward and that people could understand. So I think that this fellow helped us an awful lot with these suggestions. And so what I would recommend to my fellow peers, if they're starting, they want to write a book that's for a more popular audience, is don't hesitate to reach out and get the help of others, because there are things that we in science just don't know about that. Science writers, you know, the ones, the popular science writers that write these great novels, may know less about the science per se than a scientist in the field, but they certainly know more about how to tell an engaging story, and that you've got to respect that ability and try to learn from that. So mm-hmm. I got a tremendous education, I think, over the course of the 5 years or so that I worked on this. It was a terrific experience in that regard, but it's because I was open. I was willing to learn new tricks.
Well, you're being able to collaborate with Renaud in the first place probably means that you would be more likely to be open than maybe another person. So it's a good advice.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it was my extensive respect for him that helped out as well, is that when he would sit there and disagree with me about issues or anything, I was very respectful of him, and it opened me up to looking deeper at some of these different issues.
Yeah, okay, great. Oh, well, I want to just mention the name of the book again. It's Deadly River, Cholera and Cover-Up in Post-Earthquake Haiti, by Ralph Frericks, and the book is published by Cornell University Press. It's part of the Culture and Politics of Healthcare Work series. Professor Frericks, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me. This was a fascinating conversation, and I really enjoyed your book.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to getting some feedback from some of your listeners, and it was a fun experience to talk to you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ralph R. Frericks about his new book, Deadly River, Cholera and Cover-Up in Post-Earthquake Haiti. You can learn more about his work at two websites. One is deadlyriver.com, which is the website that Professor Frericks set up about this book. It has a lot of PDFs and maps and really interesting visuals that go along with the book. You can also Google John Snow, UCLA, and make sure that's J-O-H-N and not J-O-N, This is not Game of Thrones. If you Google John Snow, J-O-H-N, Snow, U-C-L-A, you'll get to another site that Dr. Frerichs has set up that deals a lot with work that stems from epidemiologist John Snow, who he talked about during the interview. This week's Write the Book prompt is to study a map and write about what you see there, what you learn, what places you suddenly want to travel to. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'm going to repeat a couple of announcements I made last week about the show. First, Write the Book is presently just podcasting. While we wait for access to the radiator in the former Burlington College building, we're not able to broadcast in the usual way. So stick with these podcasts and know that we'll be back on the Burlington airwaves soon. Also, Gary Miller has decided to take a break from his role as co-host, turning his attention to his own writing and to the very good work that he does with the Vermont program he helped to found, Writers for Recovery. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And as always, you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. We love to hear from you. If you have a guest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont.